This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 7 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, coming up on today's programme.
NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden describes them as his guardian angels. But will Canadian authorities look as favourably upon the three refugee families who sheltered Snowden in Hong Kong in the days after he leaked tens of thousands of secret intelligence documents?
Could UK citizens be able to hold on to the benefits of EU citizenship in a post-Brexit Britain? Well, if the comments of the EU's chief negotiator are anything to go by, Brits fearing a so-called hard Brexit might take some comfort.
Later this month, the US government will hold an international conference in Washington to consider accelerating the assault on Islamic terrorist group Daesh. But as Daesh has pushed back in all of its former strongholds, what difference will a fresh international effort make to the final outcome?
Poland has entered into a tussle with the European Union over the re-election of the former Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk as the President of the European Council. But do Polish officials risk alienating Poland even further from the EU?
And coffee and toast is a morning staple for some. What if you could have coffee on toast? Yes, apparently spreadable coffee is a thing.
All that and more over the next hour on this Friday edition of World in Focus.
When Edward Snowden, the US National Security Agency contractor, gave his first interview in a hotel in Hong Kong in 2013, revealing the scale of American global surveillance efforts, he was forced to go into immediate hiding. And it was to a group of Sri Lankan and Philippine refugees already in the former British territory that he turned and remained hidden for 2 weeks before flying to Moscow. But those same refugee families who helped Snowden are now themselves embroiled in a fight to secure a safe haven, as our reporter Mark Hurst has been finding out.
US intelligence contractor Edward Snowden described them as his guardian angels. But now the group of refugees who helped hide Snowden in Hong Kong after he publicly leaked tens of thousands of documents from the US National Security Agency are seeking sanctuary themselves. Lawyers for the group of three families who hid Snowden during his time in Hong Kong believe Sri Lankan authorities are trying to illegally arrest them in the territory and bring them back to Sri Lanka, where they fear they will be tortured and abused. Efforts are currently underway to secure asylum status in Canada, where the refugees believe they will be safe from Sri Lankan authorities. Well, on the line now from Hong Kong is the lawyer for two of the Sri Lankan refugees, Robert Thibault. Mr. Thibault also represents Edward Snowden. Mr. Thibault, can you tell me exactly what the men you represent fear if they are not granted asylum?
The situation the families are in, first and foremost, is that they had fled their native countries to Hong Kong. They had fled persecution, cruel and inhuman degrading treatment, and also torture. In Hong Kong, there's been a number of refugee or asylum screening systems, and these systems were found in the past to be so unfair that the courts in Hong Kong considered that they were illegal. So the screening systems were modified, and despite the screening systems providing for lawyers for the asylum seekers, and on the surface, the system looks fair. The actual acceptance rate of asylum seekers in Hong Kong is, since 1992, is about 73 cases out of 30,000. And since 2009, there's been 72 cases accepted. And so the acceptance rate is less than 1%. If you round it off, it's approximately 0%. So all of my clients through the Hong Kong screening system will eventually, almost with complete certainty, be rejected and then removed back to their countries of origin. Now, I want to explain that the UN Committee Against Torture in Geneva found in its fifth periodical report condemning Hong Kong for a system that has a distinctly high threshold and an almost zero acceptance rate. So from that standpoint, my clients are at risk of almost a certainty of being returned to their home countries, which that can't happen. So myself and fellow Montrealers in Quebec and Canada, we took a view that asylum claims should be filed on behalf of these three extraordinary families who sheltered Mr. Snowden. And looking at the circumstances of this family in Hong Kong, I want to give a full context. They have been left destitute in Hong Kong at all material times. In particular, the children have been affected by this. So as Canadians, we felt that with almost no chance of succeeding in their asylum claims, these families with their children left destitute, basically treated in an inhumane and degrading way, that really Hong Kong is not providing what we call state protection. They're not providing the protections that they require. Recently, we discovered that the Sri Lankan Police Criminal Investigation Department, renowned for their standard operating methods of that incorporate torture of civilians, no matter how serious the crime, they had been engaging the Sri Lankan families, extended family in Sri Lanka. They had also landed in Hong Kong, and we have evidence that they were searching for the families here in Hong Kong.
Why have the Hong Kong authorities not tried to prevent this? I mean, presumably they must be aware that Sri Lankan police are operating within their territory.
Not necessarily. The legal procedure, I mean, the proper procedure and lawful procedure, if the Sri Lankan police or any other enforcement from Sri Lanka wants to investigate in Hong Kong, they first have to contact the Hong Kong government to notify them of their intentions and basically obtain permission to do so. But from what the Sri Lankan government has said, they said that they didn't have any officers on official business in Hong Kong. But they did admit eventually that they did have officers, plural, in Hong Kong during the period where we say they were here. So it appears that the Sri Lankan officers were in Hong Kong without notifying the Hong Kong government. So it's possible the Hong Kong government didn't know. Now, we've raised this at two press conferences. We'd like to know if the Hong Kong government did know or did not. We've raised this with the Hong Kong police, and the police have referred us to the Immigration Department, saying that the Immigration Department is currently investigating the matter. So that's all we know at this stage.
There's no suggestion, I'm assuming you're not suggesting, that the Sri Lankan authorities are motivated by the fact that your clients gave refuge to Edward Snowden or not. Can you explain what the motivation was for the refugees in trying to help Snowden and whether he remains in contact with the families today?
Okay, the first part is what the motivations of the Sri Lankan authorities are. I mean, we're not clear on that. What we do know is that once my client's identities were exposed last September, the Hong Kong authorities, through a government contractor, International Social Services, questioned two of the three families about Mr. Snowden. And when the families refused to answer questions about Mr. Snowden and referred them to me as the lawyer, International Social Services cut off assistance to one of the families completely. No rent, no food, no transport, no clothing. And then another family, their basic needs weren't met. They made written requests, please, can you meet our basic needs? ISS said no after they refused to ask questions. So if the Hong Kong government is interested in Mr. Snowden, it's a certainty that the Sri Lankan authorities, you'd expect that they would be interested in Mr. Snowden.
And are the families in contact with Mr. Snowden at the moment?
The families are in contact with Mr. Snowden through Mr. Snowden's lawyers, so Jonathan Mann and myself. So when I'm in contact with Mr. Snowden or when I visited Mr. Snowden, I've passed on communications to Mr. Snowden and vice versa.
And there's no indication at this stage that the Hong Kong authorities believe that the refugees have committed a criminal offence by giving sanctuary to Ms. Snowden during those 2 weeks that he was in Hong Kong, is there?
Not at all. One thing I should make clear is, first of all, Mr. Snowden was in May and June 2013. At all material times, he had a valid visitor's visa, so he was there lawfully. When Mr. Snowden had identified himself through the interview with The Guardian, Glenn Greenwald, the United States indicted him on a number of charges under the Espionage Act for theft. But Mr. Snowden was not considered a fugitive under Hong Kong law because the U.S. had not sent through a properly formalized extradition request. So when Mr. Snowden left Hong Kong, he at all material times he was here lawfully, and he was not considered a fugitive under Hong Kong law. So the asylum-seeking families, these three wonderful families, had not broken any law in sheltering and providing assistance to Mr. Snowden.
And what are the prospects of the refugees you're representing securing asylum in Canada?
The three lawyers that I'm working with, Mr. Marc-André Siguin, Francis Tourigny, and Michael Simpkin, they're all representing the asylum-seeking families who helped Mr. Snowden. These families are in distress. They don't have the protections that are required, and Canada really is in a position to take in these families. As Mr. Trudeau has said repeatedly since last year and early this year, that Canada embraces the opportunity and embraces their commitments as a country that brings in refugees. And these are seven people that we feel Canadians would want to have have in their community. And we're hopeful that Canada will accept them.
What was the last you heard from the Canadian authorities in relation to their efforts to try and secure asylum?
This is a process that is ongoing. And all I can say is that there's been ongoing communication. And at this stage, we're asking the Canadian government to expedite these applications and to make a decision at the earliest time, if not forthwith. We're asking to make a positive decision to bring them into Canada.
Well, Mr. Thibault, fascinating case. In the meantime, many thanks for speaking to us on World in Focus.
Thanks so much, Mark. You take care.
We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Still to come on the programme, could UK citizens be able to hold on to the benefits of EU citizenship in a post-Brexit Britain? Well, if the comments of the EU's chief negotiator are anything to go by, then Brits fearing a so-called hard Brexit might take some comfort. Carolyn will be back with that and more in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
On Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in!
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know, markets are doubling down. Not, you're saying everybody's doubling down. They're crazy.
They are. Everyone's crazy.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, could UK citizens be able to hold on to the benefits of EU citizenship in a post-Brexit Britain? Well, if the comments of the EU's chief negotiator are anything to go by, Brits fearing a so-called hard Brexit might take some comfort. The Trump administration has lifted an Obama-era ban on the sale of so-called precision-guided munitions to Saudi Arabia for use against civilians in Yemen. We'll be looking at whether the move, when considered with the US Air Force's recent bombing raids in Yemen, signals the start of a new US foreign policy era in the Middle East. Later this month, the US government will hold an international conference in Washington to consider accelerating the assault on Islamic terrorist group Daesh. But as Daesh is pushed back in all of its former strongholds, what difference will a fresh international effort make to the final outcome? And coffee and toast is a morning staple for some. What if you could have coffee on toast? Yes, apparently spreadable coffee is a thing. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 14 minutes past the hour. The chief Brexit negotiator at the European Parliament, Guy Verhofstadt, has said this morning in an interview with the BBC that UK citizens might potentially be able to retain the benefits of European citizenship post-Brexit. His comments coincided with a summit in Brussels with all 27 EU leaders in attendance. For more on those developments, here's Jack Foster.
The European Parliament's lead Brexit negotiator, Guy Verhofstadt, is no stranger to stirring up the hornet's nest that is the Brexit campaign in Britain. Not that that's too difficult to do, mind you. Any call for even the remotest softening of policy tends to be received angrily by so-called hard Brexiters. And as time moves on, it's beginning to look as though that's the only kind of Brexiters there are, in terms of the people who'll be doing the negotiating, that is. It was on this morning's edition of the BBC's Today programme, though, that he said that British citizens should be allowed to keep their current benefits as EU members following Brexit, should they so desire.
All those voters want to remain in the European Union, and we have the feeling that they are lost, that nobody is defending them anymore, that they are losing a part of their identity. And it's for that reason that I'm trying to convince the European Union, not only the European Parliament, but also those who are negotiating, to take this on board, that feeling of these UK citizens. And many UK citizens say, I want to continue to have my European citizenship.
The European Parliament's lead Brexit negotiator, Guy Verhofstadt, speaking on this morning's edition of BBC Radio 4's Today programme. He also suggested that the EU Parliament could choose, if it wished, to veto any Brexit deal reached between the UK and the European Commission. His comments were obviously timely, coming as they did just hours after an informal meeting of the 27 heads of state or government, which saw a press conference this afternoon in Brussels by the EU President Jean-Claude Juncker and President of the European Council Donald Tusk. The meeting, according to both Tusk and Juncker, was not about Brexit. The extent to which that was entirely true is anyone's guess, but the idea that Brexit was not discussed or did not cloud the discussion is difficult to credit. But the focus, as explained here by President Tusk, was very much centred on the concept of a multi-speed Europe, something which could certainly be interpreted as an attempt to appease countries that might be eyeing the door following Brexit.
It is clear from the debate that the unity of the 27 will be our most precious asset. Our last meeting in Malta, subsequent opinions voiced by some member states, as well as the European Commission's white paper, leave us in no doubt that the idea of a multi-speed Europe will be one of the discussions ahead of the Rome anniversary. I understand the reasons for this. Some expect systemic changes that would loosen intra-EU ties and strengthen the role of nations in relations in relation to the community. Others, quite the opposite, are looking for new, deeper dimensions of integration, even if they would apply only to some member states. Such a possibility is indeed foreseen in the treaties currently in force. However, considering the interests of the community of 27 countries in the context of the upcoming Brexit negotiations, as well as the long-term strategic interests of the EU, I will be urging everyone to strive towards maintaining political unity among the 27. This is why, when discussing the various scenarios for Europe, our main objective should be to strengthen mutual trust and unity among 27. After today's debate, I can openly say that all 27 leaders agree with this objective. This was an optimistic discussion about our common future with a positive approach from all sides, without any exception.
President of the European Council, Donald Tusk, speaking at this afternoon's press conference in Brussels following yesterday's meeting of 27 heads of state or governments. But the topic of Brexit did come up during the Q&A section, and it was EU President Jean-Claude Juncker who made perhaps one of the more telling statements from Europe on how Brexit is being perceived.
I don't like Brexit because I would like to be in the same boat than the British. The day will come when the British will re-enter the boat, I hope. But Brexit is not the end of the European Union, nor the end of all our developments, nor the end of our continental ambitions. I had the impression, when talking privately to colleagues and when listening to the debate we had in the room, that by the contrary, the Brexit issue is encouraging the others to continue. Unfortunately, without the British. And I have seen in more or less all our member states that the approval of the European integration is having a larger adherence of the population. So Brexit is not the end. I regret it. It's not the end. We'll continue.
EU President Jean-Claude Juncker speaking at this afternoon's press conference following yesterday's meeting of 27 European heads of state and governments in Brussels. Now, our correspondent Jim Ensom was, of course, following that press conference too, and he joins me on the line now. Jim, might Guy Verhofstadt's comments bring a glimmer of hope to people in the UK hoping to retain some of the benefits of European citizenship?
It's been the big contentious issue. If you remember in Parliament, the House of Lords, which is the upper chamber of the British Parliament, were saying that before we actually go into Brexit, Theresa May, the Prime Minister of the UK, has got to guarantee the rights of EU citizens who work in so many industries, like the hospitality industry, and in transport and in the health services, guarantee their rights as part of it. And it's very interesting that Guy Verhofstadt has picked this one up and said that this really should be part of it. And he was suggesting that there might be a way through. Verhofstadt's very good on that. He is the rapporteur for Brexit negotiations for the European Parliament. He's not the only rapporteur, of course, because, of course, they've got Barnier doing it for the Commission, and you've got Donald Tusk doing it for the councils. You've got three sets of negotiations going at the same time. But it was quite interesting that Verhofstadt opens the way for suggesting that there could be some sort of associate membership to keep going the principle of the freedom of movement of people. I wonder whether this will actually come down to the freedom of movement of workers, but not people, which I think could be a very interesting negotiating point. But I think it is, it's an olive branch coming from somebody who is an arch federalist and an arch Europhile. But Verhofstadt is a realist. He's not happy that Britain is leaving. He's the ex-Belgian Prime Minister, and he fully believes in an integrated Europe and wants to see Europe integrate more. That's going to put him at odds, of course, with Theresa May. But on the other hand, this is an interesting suggestion.
He did, I mean, perhaps in slightly less of an olive branch type way, say that the European Parliament would have the power to veto any deal brokered by the UK and the European Commission. What does that really mean in reality?
I love that. You see, the reality is that the negotiations are going to have to come under Michel Barnier, who's the European Commission's chief negotiator. So that's one of the institutions with its negotiator, and they think they're taking the lead. Meanwhile, of course, there's the Council, which is the leaders of all the countries, and that is the president of that, after a 27-1 vote yesterday, was Donald Tusk. And, of course, Verhofstadt says, hang on a minute, I want to have the final say on this. This was his political point. What he was saying is, I don't care what the Commission deal is. I don't care what the Council says. But in the end, it's still going to have to come back to me, because Verhofstadt is a lovely chap, very nice indeed. But he's still saying, we still have the power. We can block a deal. Now, whether that deal says no, go back and rethink it, and overgo the two-year period, which is the length of time ostensibly the Article 50 suggests that the negotiations should take, so they've got a timetable for it, or whether or not it simply means if we don't like the deal, there won't be a Brexit. But basically, he was making a political point that he, of all the people in the European Parliament, he is the one that's going to have the final say on this, irrespective of what Juncker and Barnier do at the Commission and irrespective of what Tusk does. He was playing European politics, as he often does.
I wonder if we could just quickly move to the press conference this afternoon in Brussels, where we had a lot of talk about multi-speed Europe. Is that really anything more than a sop to Eurosceptics outside of the UK who might be looking at their own version of Brexit?
I was watching it with great interest. Jean-Claude Juncker, the President of the Commission, and Donald Tusk, the President of the Council, their body language was very, very interesting. Juncker, I think he said in his speech that basically there's a new European EU prosecutor's office being launched this week, but not all the members are part of it. You know, there's only 10 states actually signed up to this. And there's several other things are being agreed, which not all 28 members are signed up to. And I could see quite clearly that from the discussions they'd had and when they came in front of us, all the press crew that were there, the television cameras and everything, I could see from his body language that he was conceding that, look, you know, if we are to unite Europe, we've got to remain friends within Europe. But he accepted and used the word several times, the phrase multi-speed Europe. He said, we've already started this. He said, you know, there are already several things that have now been agreed with all of us that some of us agree not to be part of. Now, to a certain extent, this has taken me back many, many years to the signing of the Maastricht Treaty. The Maastricht Treaty was signed up by all 28 members, except, of course, Britain and Ireland didn't go as part of Schengen, and they opted out of part of the social chapter. So Europe has a history of remaining together while at the same time agreeing to disagree over certain things. And compared with his State of the Union speech, which he gave in September in 2016, I got this very, very strong feeling, and certainly from Donald Tusk as well, that Juncker was saying, look, we've got to be pragmatic about this, and post-Brexit, the EU27 will stay together, and you know, will stay together, but it could be a different type of Europe.
Very quickly, just before I let you go, what about Juncker's comments about the UK coming back on board the boat that hits the European Union? Was that more of a heartfelt pro-Europe sentiment or perhaps more deliberate antagonism towards Brexiters?
I took it the other way, to be quite frank with you. Juncker has been very voluble on Brexit over you know, recent weeks and months, but the reality is said, we still want Britain on board, and I still retain the hope that Britain will come back on board. I think that came from the heart. I think that's Juncker being pragmatic and realistic.
Sputnik's Jim Ensom there. And, of course, the clock is ticking in the UK as the inevitable triggering of Article 50 looms ever closer. It was supposed to be by the end of this month, and as yet it still could be, dependent on how easily the Brexit bill continues to navigate its way through the Houses of Parliament. As the days go by, we get occasional glimpses into the position the European Union could take during Brexit negotiations, which is more than can be said for that of the UK government, who are continuing to keep their cards very close to their chests. Inside of the UK, Brexit may mean Brexit, but still, few know what Brexit actually means. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
This is Radio Sputnik. This is World in Focus. I'm Carolyn Scott, and it's 26 minutes past the hour. The Trump administration is to renew a controversial weapons sale of precision-guided munitions to Saudi Arabia. The decision to prohibit selling the weapons to the Gulf Kingdom was made during the last few months of the Obama administration in reaction to an airstrike on a funeral ceremony in Yemen that killed at least 140 people. For more on this, here's Matthew Aiton.
Donald Trump's administration will resume the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia that have been used in the killing of civilians in Yemen. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson approved a measure this week facilitating the sale of precision-guided munitions to the Gulf Kingdom, suggesting a strategic shift in U.S. foreign policy toward a more pro-Saudi position on Yemen. The resumption of the sale of so-called precision-guided weapons marks the end of a ban imposed during the last months of the Obama administration on selling weapons to Saudi Arabia that were being used as part of its bombing campaign against Houthi rebels in Yemen. A senior official who spoke to the Washington Post on condition of anonymity said that the Trump administration is planning to organize a pushback against Iranian influence in Yemen. The official said that, quote, "We'll be looking for ways to blunt Iranian malign influence in the region, and we'll be looking for all of the tools that the US government has. In that context, I think you have to look at Yemen." The decision comes on the heels of a recent intensification in airstrike campaigns by the Trump administration over the last week in Yemen, allegedly targeting Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, also known by the acronym of AQAP. Well, joining us to try and make sense of this decision by the Trump administration is former US ambassador to Yemen, Gerald Feirstein. Mr. Feirstein, thanks for joining us here on World in Focus. Okay, so firstly, could you explain for our listeners what type of weapons will be sold to Saudi Arabia, and why do you suppose the Trump administration has made this decision now?
Well, my understanding is that what we're talking about here are precision-guided munitions, and this is a request that dates back to the latter part of the Obama administration. The Obama administration had made a decision last fall that they weren't going to send or sell additional PGMs to Saudi Arabia in response to what happened, the unfortunate incident at the funeral hall last October. So this has been something that's been on the table for about 6 months. The Trump administration, which seems in general to be more supportive, more inclined to be supportive of Saudi efforts in Yemen, has decided to move forward with this.
Some might argue here that it's a great shame after the Obama administration imposed a ban on the sale of these weapons in protest of the Saudi Air Force's targeting of civilians in Yemen, that the Trump administration has now decided to reverse course. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say, one, of course, what happened at the funeral hall was a terrible incident and a tragic incident. There's no reason to believe, there's no reason or evidence to suggest that it was anything other than a tragic mistake. I believe that for several reasons. One, it's in our interest to provide Saudi Arabia with the kind of weapons that hopefully will reduce the potential for this kind of collateral damage or error, that it's in the U.S. interest to be more supportive of the Saudis to help them avoid making mistakes, and not to forget, one, that Saudi Arabia is a partner of the United States, that we share many common interests on regional security and stability, and therefore we should try to be helpful to them. And also not to forget that what the Saudis are trying to accomplish in Yemen is, in fact, supportive of the U.S. policy and the U.S. position as well.
Has it not, though, been demonstrated time and time again that the word precision in the name precision-guided missiles is, well, at the least something to be questioned? In Yemen, but also in places beyond, like the Gaza Strip, civilians have been killed in their tens by these weapons, and this can definitely be said for cluster munitions, of which Saudi Arabia is also using. Would you not agree?
Well, cluster munitions are something entirely different, and of course there was a decision that that goes back well before the decision on the precision-guided munitions not to sell additional cluster bomb units to Saudi Arabia. That, as far as I know, is not under review, and that there's no indication that that's going to be reversed. The precision-guided munitions are exactly what they say they are. They are precision-guided munitions, meaning that they hit what they're supposed to be hitting.
Some might say evidently not, though.
Well, I would question that. I think, you know, the issue isn't whether the munitions are hitting what they're supposed to hit. It's whether
the civilians just happen to be in the vicinity at the wrong time.
Well, there are collateral damage issues. There's also, you know, if the target is poorly selected, if you misidentify, which is what happened in the funeral hall, if you misidentify the target and believe that it's a military target versus something else, then the results can be tragic. But that doesn't question the accuracy or the precision of the munition.
Well, moving on, over the last week, the Trump administration has, as I'm sure you're aware, intensified its air campaign on Yemen, allegedly hitting upward of 40 targets over the last 4 days. And in one attack, a former Guantanamo Bay detainee was killed. Taken with these renewed arms sales to Saudi Arabia, do you think that this signals the start of a wider or renewed U.S. strategy vis-a-vis Yemen or perhaps the Middle East more generally?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the growing concern here about the resurgence of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and the fact that Al-Qaeda has been able to take advantage of the conflict, the civil conflict in Yemen and the political chaos to regain much of the ground that it lost in the period 2012 to 14. And so I think that the administration is correctly concerned about the implications for that, not only for Yemen and the region, but globally, if AQ is able to once again use ungoverned space in Yemen for launching attacks against targets all around the world. So I think that this is a reflection of that. It's a determination to try to reverse that that change. I think it's justifiable. What I said yesterday in my testimony in the Senate is that it's essential that we not slip on our standards, the standards that were applied previously of ensuring no collateral damage, that we need to make sure that the intelligence that we have about the targets is absolutely correct and accurate. And that, you know, understanding that the fight against Al-Qaeda in Yemen, like the fight against violent extremist organizations around the world, is a long term fight. And we need to ensure that while we pursue these targets and pursue these objectives, that we keep the goodwill and the cooperation of the Yemeni population on our side, which means avoiding unnecessary civilian casualties.
Well, this ties in nicely with what I wanted to ask you next. Why the AQAP and why now? Surely there are greater threats unfolding across the region, like the Daesh presence in Syria. And besides, have the AQAP not always been in Yemen? So why are they deciding to take the threat so seriously now?
Well, I think that if you go back a couple of years, you'll recognize and recall that AQAP was considered at one time to be among the most, if not the most, potent threat to global security from terrorism. And I think that some of the individuals, there's the bomb maker Asiri, who is still in Yemen, as far as we know. There are others who, given an opportunity, we believe would go back to their goals of global jihad and of launching terrorism in many places around the world. And so I would say that while you have certainly concerns about Daesh and other extremist organizations around the world, the requirement to really address the AQAP threat is going to be very high on people's calculation.
Okay, and just finally, the Trump administration, of course, talks a lot about rolling back Iranian influence in the region and cites that reason for lifting this arms sales ban on Saudi Arabia. But isn't there truth in the argument that Saudi Arabia's regional role, which has included the arming of groups in Syria which can quite comfortably be described as borderline jihadist, has been much more pernicious in the region?
Well, of course, I think that we would disagree with the idea that these are borderline jihadist groups. I think that, you know, that we have worked very closely with the Saudis to ensure that the groups that we're supporting in Syria are, in fact, the moderate Syrian opposition, who represent, in our view, the vast majority of Sunni population of Syria.
Groups like Ahrar al-Sham?
Well, I think, you know, there are degrees within of these groups, and again, the groups that we're supporting, the groups that the Saudis are supporting, are the moderate groups that we believe represent the future of Syria, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity, you know, when there is a peaceful resolution of the Syrian conflict, to actually achieve responsibility and authority in the government.
Okay, Gerald Feirstein, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
This is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 38 minutes past the hour. While Russia and its coalition partners continue their offensive against Daesh, the US have signalled they wish to accelerate their own separate coalition efforts to attack the Islamic terror group. US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will host a conference later this month that aims to bring together an even broader international coalition for the final push against Daesh. Our reporter Mark Hurst has this.
The U.S. State Department this week announced it would convene a conference of the U.S. coalition established to attack Daesh, the Islamic extremist group currently in Syria and Iraq. The 6-to-8-nation coalition will meet in Washington on the 22nd and 23rd of March to discuss ways to accelerate the attack on Daesh. Russia, which is already part of a separate international military coalition fighting in Syria, are not expected to be invited to the Washington talks. But with Daesh already being driven back in many of its previous strongholds, what difference, if any, will a fresh US-led coalition make to the outcome of the present ongoing offensive against the extremists? Earlier I spoke with Dr. David Lowe, a leading expert on counter-terrorism and a principal lecturer at the John Muir's University Law School in Liverpool. Dr. Lowe, thanks for joining us on World in Focus. The US State Department, in announcing this conference, has confirmed it will include a number of Middle Eastern states. How significant is that in terms of the fight against Daesh?
I think it's significant in for a couple of ways. One, it's showing and should definitely get across to President Trump the number of states that Daesh actually impact upon. And in fact, while there may be some differences in how some states operate, we have more in common in trying to deal with this group than we have differences. And certainly it may sort of help have a positive slant maybe in how President Trump currently has been dealing with foreign affairs, and perhaps he may realise that there's more to do in working, more can be achieved by working in cooperation than actually sort of giving out views that can be seen as antagonistic or towards a certain state that could damage some relationships. So I'm quite positive at this, and certainly if he gets all 68 states there, this is giving out a big message.
And there seems to be little doubt that Daesh is very much on the back foot at the moment and being pushed back. Is their demise inevitable, or could we see them morphing into some kind of different kind of threat or establishing themselves elsewhere?
Yeah, I think geographically we are now starting to see the retreat of Daesh and the control of its territory. It's virtually lost all of it in Libya now. It's lost large amounts in Syria, and of course the battle for Mosul, which is ongoing. It's only a matter of time before they lose that battle.
But Afghanistan's proving a bit of a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was quite sad to see that Daesh actually carried out that attack the other day on the hospital there. But it shows you that this group has attacked countries all around the world. We've seen it in Jakarta and Indonesia. I mean, obviously, Iraq itself. I mean, the number of casualties in Baghdad just last year, over 1,000, shows you, and other areas that they've attacked. It's not just an anti-Western group, this. This is a group that, if no one follows their ideology, and this is the point I was going to make, was while they're losing geographically, the next big battle is trying to deal with their ideology. And as you said, they may morph into something else that is just as toxic and just as dangerous as what we've seen. And I think this is where hopefully this summit they'll be looking at that issue as well. It's not just about removing them from Iraq and Syria. It's now, what do you do in the next steps? How are you going to take this forward? How are they going to deal with individuals who are being inspired by this group and so on? Look at that area to try and have some continuity amongst the states. And I think that will be a very positive way forward.
And the US is making a lot of the broad coalition here, but in fact not all of these countries may be directly engaged in military operations if they agree to accelerate them. Is that likely to change, though?
Well, it's an interesting point. I think this is where you have to sort of take a step back and look at what the greater good. I mean, there's already been some great strides taken with Russia and Turkey having summits with the different Syrian groups. Obviously, Daesh and Jabhat al-Sham are not there, but it's looking at that area. And I think early days for me, what I thought was quite positive to start with, but doesn't seem to have panned out as well as it could have done, was the early days when you had the US-led coalition, you had Turkey's involvement coming in, Russia involved. It would have been even better if all those states could have worked together. And maybe, just maybe from the summit, they've in realizing that there is more in common, that it might just put one or two little diplomatic feuds to one side and let's work for the greater good and move forward. So it could be the other way. It could be that most states will start working even closer together.
Picking up on that point, I interviewed David Kilcullen last year, the US State Department's former chief counterterrorism strategist, and he said exactly that point, that the US and Russia should be working together in Syria, given they both have a common enemy in Daesh. But it seems unlikely that'll happen for political and domestic reasons in the US at the moment. Is that likely to change? I mean, does this conference offer the opportunity for the US to reset its relations with Russia?
Well, I would certainly hope so. I think any time you have a conference, a summit, whatever it is, and people get together under one roof, here is a golden opportunity, and it should always be taken. I mean, I know over the last few years there's been a fractious relationship between the US and Russia. And maybe with President Trump now being elected and some of the overtures that he's been making towards Russia has been quite positive. So maybe there's that time to grasp that nettle and try and work together in cooperation, because it's far better if we all work together than sort of work off on our own and do our own thing. It's far more effective if we are together.
And finally, it's rarely mentioned, but this very dark period in Middle Eastern history has its origins in the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Do you think political strategists in the West properly understand that?
I think they do now. It was quite clearly an issue, as it wasn't just about beating the Saddam regime in a conventional warfare. I think the first week or so that we saw that, it was then the power vacuum that was left. And we saw a similar thing in Libya with Colonel Gaddafi, with his fall. A power vacuum was left. I think most states now, if they're looking to take some positive action in that region, must have not just a plan A of let's deal with the immediate situation. There's got to be a plan B. What are we going to do once that conflict's over? How are we going to bring this country back together? And don't underestimate the differences that are there. I mean, you look at some dictatorships in the past that they've actually been able to unify a number of different factions in a state. And I think that may have been underestimated. And that's certainly one big lesson that's been learned from Iraq. And I would say Libya as well. It's been an issue. And you look at what Libya's going through now, as well as what's going on in Syria and Iraq.
Dr. Lowe, many thanks for speaking to us on World in Focus.
You're welcome.
Dr. David Lowe there, a leading expert on counter-terrorism and a principal lecturer at the John Muir's University Law School in Liverpool. Mark Hurst, World in Focus.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, Poland has entered into a tussle with the European Union over the re-election of former Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk as the President of the European Council. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, Poland has entered into a tussle with the European Union over the re-election of former Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk as President of the European Council. But do Polish officials risk alienating Poland even further from the European Union? And coffee and toast is a morning staple for some, but what if you could have coffee on toast? Yes, spreadable coffee is apparently a thing. A row between Poland and the EU was kicked off this week by the Warsaw government's opposition to the re-election of Donald Tusk as President of the European Council. Donald Tusk is a former Polish Prime Minister and opponent of Poland's ruling Law and Justice Party, or PIS by its Polish acronym. The Polish government had put forward its own candidate, but was outvoted 27-1, putting it at odds with all the other EU member states, marking a new low in the already tense relationship between Warsaw and the European Union. The Polish government has been in dispute with the Commission for more than a year and has been given a series of warnings, including a threat to withdraw Poland's voting rights in the EU, a sanction that has never before been invoked. The latest spat over the Tusk's appointment may leave Poland even more isolated within the EU, particularly because it did not get the backing of its fellow partners in the Visegrad Group, those being the Czech Republic, Hungary and Slovakia. During a press conference this afternoon in Brussels, Donald Tusk was asked about the atmosphere at last night's European Council working dinner, given his home nation's stance against his re-election.
Yesterday's atmosphere was very optimistic, at least for me, you know. But today it was absolutely clear for all of us that the approach for, and I'm talking about all sides, I mean all 27 member states, including Poland, the attitude was much more constructive and positive. And it was something very tangible. I mean, this positive and even optimistic atmosphere. I will be in contact with the Polish government. It's obvious, and I proposed today to establish a direct cooperation also between our European Council meetings here in Brussels, and I hope that my Polish colleagues will be able to accept my proposal.
President of the European Council, Donald Tusk, speaking at a press conference earlier today. But it was not only the election process itself which saw Poland effectively snubbed by fellow member states. Following Tusk's re-election, Polish officials threatened to block the summit conclusions, which ordinarily require signing off from all member states. In a rather unprecedented move, the conclusions were published with the following statement. Quote, "The European Council deliberated on the attached document. It was supported by 27 members of the European Council, but it did not gather consensus for reasons unrelated to its substance. References to the European Council in the attached document should not be read as implying a formal endorsement by the European Council acting as an institution," end quote. It is rather irregular for a country to reject the summit conclusions. Earlier, I spoke to Agnieszka Wyszniewska, editor of Polish media outlet Political Critique. I asked her if, given that Poland failed to secure the support of even its closest allies, she thought Poland risked becoming even more alienated.
I think it was not a very smart idea, like what the Law and Justice did. For sure, everything what the Polish government is doing is focused on internal politics, not external, not international politics. They have no idea how to do the politics in Europe, and we can see this right now. So it was a very stupid idea to block Donald Tusk. And just to show that they would like to be some kind of independent from Europe, which is very, like, not smart. And they, of course, they failed. And now they were going to use this to show to the, in Poland, inside, that if they do something, if they were going to do something wrong, and then European Union will going to react, they were going to tell, look, but this is people who they don't trust us, like we didn't want them, we didn't choose them. So they were going to build like the strong opposition between Poland and the European Union, which is not very smart.
Is it likely to cause any rise in anti-EU sentiment in Poland?
No, I think at this moment Polish politics is really divided. And so you have, of course, the government and the ruling party, which is maybe not anti-Euro, but they are anti-liberal. Like they are anti the citizen platform, the party that ruled before them, the party ruled by Donald Tusk also. So, and they would like to show that Poland is independent, whatever it means. So this is one group. And on the other hand, you have really strong feeling that Poland is a part of Europe, that joining European Union was very important for us, and it gave us opportunity to develop many things like human rights, in the building like the open society, this kind of things. So it's and also it was a huge financial support. So I think at this moment, like, the society is very divided.
As you said a moment ago, this is really effectively an internal Polish dispute which has been translated to the international stage. And that was echoed by the Belgian Prime Minister, and he said that the EU leaders have no time for this. Now, they also tried to block the summit conclusions unsuccessfully. They have since been published. Really, it seems like Polish government have showed their hand here, and they don't have any play left. Where do they go from here?
Now, like, the Polish government is going to nowhere on this international European level. Like, for sure, we can see how the situation in European Union looks like. Even now, we have this two speeds of Europe. Like, we have Europe A and Europe B. And this is informal. It's easy can change to this really formal division between the Europe A, which is much more united, and the periphery. And for sure, Poland will be part of the periphery. But honestly, this is what I thought maybe 1 month ago or 2 months ago. But now, after what the Law and Justice is doing, and after what also Janusz Korwin-Mikke said in European, one of the members of European Parliament, what he said about women, which is like really ugly and awful. I think that the Poland can lose the chance even to be like the part of important peripheries. Like, we are on the straight way to be like kicked off from the Europe.
And is that a fear that people in Poland have right now? Is that quite a widespread thing in Poland? There's this fear that you lose track of your standing in the European Union.
I think it's, you know, it's not like the government, the ruling party, they doesn't want to leave European Union, of course. But what they are doing, it will gonna build the situation when, even if Poland, of course, still will be part of European Union, it will be like total peripheries, and it will be like the country which is like not important. No one cares what's going on there. Like, everyone can see that the politicians doesn't think like seriously about European politics. They are focused only on some national discussions, national fights. And it's like, so Poland was a serious partner for years. Like, when we joined European Union, we were a serious actor, political actor in the region, in Central and Eastern Europe. That's why Donald Tusk, like, have this important function. But everything what the government is doing right now is really a short way to be to be still, of course, inside European Union, but be treated but be not a serious actor, not a serious partner.
Mm-hmm. And just finally, one last thing. What impact is this likely to have on relations with traditional allies such as Hungary and Slovakia, who didn't back up Poland in this vote?
I think Poland, I think Law and Justice, the government, they are sure that they will gonna have support from Hungary, from Viktor Orban, from Slovakia, from Czech Republic. But when you see how Orban is doing the internet, like, foreign policy, and how Kaczynski is doing, you can see the difference between them. Very often I can hear that Orban and Kaczynski are very similar. Yes, that's true, they are, but there is one important difference between them, and the difference is how they are doing foreign policy. Orban is much more better in this. He knows how to even like build coalitions in Europe, how to do this politics on not only on the national level. And Kaczynski has no idea how to do this. That's why he cannot even. That's why Kaczynski can support Orban, but he cannot think that Orban will gonna support him, because Orban is like knows that it doesn't have any sense to support such a crazy guy as Kaczynski.
Mm-hmm. Well, Agnieszka Wyszynewska, thank you so much for joining us on World in Focus today.
Thank you.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
Finally for today, spreadable coffee is apparently a thing in Japan. What do you think of spreadable coffee, Jack?
Well, I don't actually have any right here, Carolyn, but
You
can see, I have a printout of it.
This is lovely.
This isn't really working for the benefit of our listeners, but it looks a little bit like chocolate spread. It's a Japanese thing, and I have to say, I would try that.
I would try it. Unfortunately, it's not got that much caffeine in it, so it's not really useful as a caffeine substitute, but it's just kind
but
of
But I quite like coffee,
spreads.
And I quite like chocolate spread.
Yeah.
And I don't mind toast.
Yeah, it's a bit odd. I'd try to give it a shot.
This is one of the finest pieces of news coverage ever.
Well, you're the one that brought a
on
picture,
World in Focus.
Brought a picture into a radio studio.
And look where we would have been without the picture, Carolyn.
Well, perhaps, fortunately, that is all that we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, and in just a moment we'll be handing over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartmann Show. Until tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster.
And from me, Carolyn Scott. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, master's revolution, imperialism, master's democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.